Welcome back to the Deep Dive, everybody. Today we're taking a look at, well, we're going to be diving deep into a Second Circuit case. United States v. Tropiano and Barroso. And I think it's really packed with great learning points for anyone in the legal world, especially I think about evidence and criminal procedure.
Absolutely. You know, this is a case that I think really gets into some of the fascinating areas of law and procedure.
Yeah.
At its heart, it's about securities fraud. It's about a scheme, allegedly,
that
was orchestrated by three brokers. And what we're talking about here, I mean, you know, we're talking forged documents. We're talking about account transfers that were not authorized and a lot of money, over $150,000 in client funds going missing.
Oh, my gosh.
But what's really interesting for us, you know, I think for this deep dive in particular, is how this case really grapples with some fundamental legal principles, right? So we're talking about the hearsay exceptions. We're talking about the Sixth Amendment and the Confrontation Clause. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about the difference between just knowing about something and then actually intending to be a part of it.
Right.
And I think this case really is instructive. It's almost like a masterclass in how these procedural rules kind of interact with, you know, a very real and complex prosecution of a financial crime.
Okay, well, let's get into it then. Let's talk about this alleged fraudulent scheme. And you said it took place at a brokerage firm called Briarwood.
That's right.
And you mentioned we've got the Tropiano brothers, that's Frederick and Marlon Tropiano, and then also this David Barroso.
That's right.
So what were they actually accused of doing?
So the allegations here involved the forging of letters. So basically what they were doing is they were impersonating clients to get authorization to transfer accounts without permission. And, you know, once they had control of the account, they'd liquidate the investment. So that means taking the stocks or the assets in the account, turning those into cash.
Uh-huh.
And then that cash, and we're talking about, you know, significant amount of money here, over $150,000.
Oh.
It was allegedly directed to accounts that were controlled by these very brokers.
Okay, and so then, as you mentioned before, two of them, Frederick and Marlon, plead guilty before the trial even started.
That's right.
Leaving just David Barroso to stand trial. And I guess he claimed he was totally duped, like totally in the dark.
Yeah, I mean, this is what makes this case so interesting, right? Because now you have two individuals who've admitted their guilt, and you have Barroso who's saying, no, I had nothing to do with this. I was taken advantage of. Yeah, I was completely innocent.
Right.
And so the prosecution's got a big challenge here. Right. They have to try to prove that he was knowingly involved in this conspiracy, despite the fact that, you know, his alleged co-conspirators have already admitted their guilt.
Right.
And so this is where the evidence and how the court rules on that evidence becomes really, really crucial.
Well, speaking of the evidence, so it sounds like from the start, the prosecution kind of came out with some pretty damning direct stuff.
Right.
You mentioned before about these taped conversations. What did those reveal?
Yeah, so the taped conversations are really interesting here because they kind of cut to the heart of Barroso's defense, right? They weren't just kind of vague statements. Mm-hmm. They actually captured him in clear lies. So he's lying on these tapes about having the authority to actually access client accounts.
Wow.
There was also evidence of him endorsing checks that were tied directly to the fraudulent liquidation of these very accounts.
That's pretty damning.
Yeah. I mean, this is not looking good for Barroso, right? It seems like it contradicts his claim that he was completely unaware of what was going on.
Right. So I guess it almost sounds like an open and shut case, but then it sounds like things get a little complicated or at least a little more interesting with this next piece of evidence.
Yeah.
You mentioned the plea allocutions of the Tropiano brothers.
Right.
Now, for anyone listening who might not be as familiar with that legal term, first of all, what is a plea allocution? And then second of all, why were these particular allocutions so important for the prosecution's case against Barroso?
Yeah, so a plea allocution, it's basically a formal statement that a defendant makes in court when they're pleading guilty. And essentially what they're doing is they're outlining the factual basis for their crimes.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, when Frederick and Marlon Tropiano plead guilty, they admitted to conspiring with others.
Okay.
And so now the prosecution wants to use that, those admissions, against Barroso to say, look, there was a conspiracy and Barroso was one of those unnamed others.
Right. But as soon as I hear, you know, a statement like that being used against someone else, I immediately think, well, that sounds like hearsay.
Yeah.
So explain why these plea allocutions were considered hearsay, and then how the prosecution was trying to use the law to try and get them admitted against Barroso in the trial.
Yeah, so hearsay, right. It's an out-of-court statement that's being offered in court to prove the truth of whatever is being asserted.
Right.
And generally, we know hearsay is not admissible, right? But of course, there are exceptions to the hearsay rule, and that's what makes evidence law so interesting.
Right. Of course, there's exceptions.
And so the prosecution's argument here was that the Tropiano's statements, they fell under an exception called the statement against interest exception. And specifically, this is Federal Rule of Evidence 804b3. Now, the thinking behind this exception is that, you know, if somebody makes a statement that's so clearly against their own best interest, like admitting to a crime, then it's considered more likely to be true, right? Because why would they say something that would expose them to criminal liability if it weren't true?
Right. Yeah, it makes sense. They're incriminating themselves, so it must be true.
Right. So it has like this ring of truth, of reliability to it, because it's so harmful to the person who's actually making this statement.
So then I guess Barroso's defense team stepped in here. What was their argument against admitting this seemingly very strong evidence from the prosecution?
So their big argument here was that even if these plea allocutions fit under this hearsay exception, even if they technically qualify,
right,
they were saying, look, using them against Barroso violates his Sixth Amendment right to confront witnesses.
Okay.
Which is a very important right.
Huge.
Absolutely. The Confrontation Clause, it guarantees that in a criminal case,
yeah,
you have the right to actually face the people who are testifying against you, to cross-examine them.
Right.
And so because the Tropianos weren't actually there in court, they weren't on the witness stand for Barroso to question them directly, his lawyers were saying, look, this is unconstitutional. You can't use this against him.
Right.
So it's a very interesting argument.
Okay, so then that takes us to this really nuanced part of the case involving Marlon Tropiano in a specific statement. And it wasn't just him saying that he conspired with others, right? There was this follow-up question that the prosecutor asked him that really adds this whole other layer to the case.
Absolutely. So, you know, first Marlon says, I conspired with others.
Mm-hmm.
But then the prosecutor follows up. He said, well, how many others? And Marlon's response is, more than one. So the Second Circuit, they agreed that the initial statement, you know, that conspired with others, that was admissible. That was a statement against interest. But they drew a really important distinction when it came to that second statement, that more than one.
Okay, so walk us through the court's reasoning then. Why was that follow-up more than one deemed inadmissible when the initial admission wasn't? Like, what's the legal nuance there that we need to understand?
Right, so here's how the court breaks it down. They said, look, once Marlon admitted to conspiring with others, he had basically confessed to his crime, right?
Yeah.
He admitted to the conspiracy charge. Answering the question more than one, well, that might implicate Barroso.
Right.
But it doesn't really add anything to his own criminal liability.
Uh-huh.
Right. He already admitted he was part of a conspiracy. So the court basically says, look, he has nothing to lose at this point by implicating Barroso. And because of that, it kind of undermines that reliability.
Okay.
That trustworthiness that the statement against interest exception relies on.
Right.
It wasn't a statement that really hurt him,
mm-hmm.
right? It wasn't really against his own interest in any truly significant way. So that's a big deal.
Okay. So it's this really fine line, right?
Yeah.
Where just because one part of a statement might be okay to use under a hearsay exception doesn't mean everything that follows is also good to go, right? Like, it needs to be like its own mini statement against interest.
Absolutely.
Good. Is that right?
Absolutely. It really emphasizes this idea that you need this direct self-inculpatory nature to every single part of the statement.
Got it.
For it to really qualify. It can't just be something extra. It can't just be, you know, an additional detail that doesn't actually hurt the person saying it.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like if you admit to eating a whole cake, right?
Yeah.
If you say, ate the whole cake, and then they say, well, how many slices did you eat? And you're like, well, more than one. You know, it doesn't really change the fact that you ate the whole cake.
Right, right, right.
That first admission is kind of all you need.
Yeah, it's already damning, right?
Right. So that second part, that more than one, it's not really as trustworthy in terms of this exception.
Got it. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. And I think that's super helpful for, you know, any of our listeners who are really trying to understand the nuances of evidence. But then, you know, even though we have this error now, this statement that was wrongly admitted, Barroso is still convicted. His conviction is upheld. So how does that work? It seems a little counterintuitive, right? Because if evidence is admitted that shouldn't have been, isn't that grounds for like a whole new trial?
So this is where we get into the concept of harmless error.
Yeah.
So the appellate court here, they said, look, we agree it was a mistake to admit that more than one statement,
mm-hmm.
but we don't think it actually affected the outcome of the trial.
Okay.
Because there was so much other evidence
right.
that pointed to Barroso's guilt.
Right, right. Going back to those tape conversations where he was lying about having authority.
Yeah, exactly. And the checks and all of that. So basically it was like, yeah, that one statement shouldn't have been there. But even without it, it's so clear
right.
that he was guilty.
That the jury would come to the same conclusion.
Exactly.
Got it. Okay, now, there was also this mention of a jury instruction on conscious avoidance. Now, again, for some of our listeners who might not be familiar with that legal term, first of all, what does that mean? And then how did it play into this case?
Yeah, so conscious avoidance, it's a really interesting concept, right? It allows a jury to basically infer that a defendant knew about something illegal.
Okay.
Even if there's not direct proof that they knew.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
So basically, if the evidence shows that they deliberately avoided learning about the illegal thing, then the jury can say, well, they must have known, right? They just didn't want to, find out.
They had a bad feeling and just didn't want to know.
Exactly. So in this case, the jury was told that they could assume Barroso knew about the fraud if they found that he had deliberately avoided learning the truth about it.
Okay.
But, and this is a really important but.
Yeah.
The instruction also said that conscious avoidance alone was not enough to prove that he intended to be a part of the conspiracy.
Okay, that makes sense. So you can't just assume, oh, well, they probably knew something was up, so they must have been part of it from the beginning.
Exactly, exactly. So that difference between knowing something and intending to do something,
right.
that's super important in this case.
Especially in a conspiracy case.
Because
if you don't have the intent from the beginning, then...
then you're not part of the conspiracy.
You're not part of the conspiracy.
Right. So the court was very clear about this. They said the jury had to find that Barroso actually intended to enter into this illegal agreement.
Okay.
And, you know, knowing something was up is one thing, but you've got to prove that intent.
Right. That's the key part.
Right. And the fact that the judge was so careful about how they worded this instruction, that actually played a big role in the appellate court's decision.
Oh,
you know, to uphold the conviction. Yeah.
Okay. So stepping back a little bit and thinking about our listeners, especially the law students out there who are really trying to absorb all this stuff.
Right.
What would you say are like the key lessons to take away from United States v. Tropiano and Barroso? What should they really be highlighting in their notes?
Yeah, I think there are a few really big takeaways here.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I think this case shows just how carefully courts will scrutinize statements that are made during plea deals,
mm-hmm.
right? Especially when those statements are then being used against somebody else who wasn't part of that plea deal.
Right.
So the Second Circuit's ruling, you know, the way they handled that more than one statement, it's a great example of the limitations of the statement against interest exception, right?
Yeah.
804B3. This is something that comes up a lot in evidence law. And I think this case is a really good reminder that just because a statement might partially qualify for an exception doesn't mean every single thing in that statement is going to be admissible.
Right.
You know, it has to really be against the person's interest.
Has to hurt them.
It has to hurt them in some way. Yeah.
Okay. And I guess that's also a really important point, you know, strategically for prosecutors and defense attorneys, right?
Absolutely.
So for a prosecutor who's trying to use a statement like this, you know, they can't just use these broad admissions from a co-defendant to try to implicate somebody else.
Right. It has to be very specific. Yeah. And it has to be clear that, you know, this statement is actually harming the person who made it.
Got it. Okay.
And then the second big takeaway, I think, is it really highlights the importance of the conscious avoidance doctrine.
Uh-huh.
But it also shows how crucial it is for judges to be very, very clear in their jury instructions about how this doctrine works. You know, they have to explain to the jury that, yes, you can assume that somebody knew something was up based on their actions.
Right.
But that assumption alone that's not enough to prove that they actually intended to be a part of the crime.
Right.
It's a very subtle distinction.
Yeah.
But it's really important, especially in a conspiracy case.
Absolutely. And you know, it's so interesting to me just how easy it can be to kind of overlook some of these seemingly small procedural details, you know? But then when we do these deep dives, we realize just how impactful those rules of evidence in criminal procedure are.
Yeah, absolutely.
And how they can really sway the outcome of a trial.
They really can. And, you know, for those of you who are really digging into the, you know, the specifics here, it's worth noting that this case also touches on this idea of authenticating evidence.
Oh, right.
Right. So Federal Rule of Evidence 901.
Yeah.
You know, we had those taped conversations, right?
Yeah.
Those were really crucial for the prosecution.
Right.
But in order to use them, they had to prove that those tapes were authentic, that they were the real deal.
Right.
And so the fact that the people who were on those tapes, the people who participated in those conversations, were able to come into court and say, yes, that's me on the tape. That's my voice.
Right.
That was a really important step in getting that evidence admitted.
So it's really highlighting just how many different levels of procedure there are to really make it a strong case.
Yeah. It's a great reminder that all of these rules, even the ones that might seem kind of technical,
right,
they really matter.
Yeah.
They play a big role in how these cases play out.
Absolutely. So in the end, Barroso's conviction was upheld largely because of all that other evidence that we talked about, those tapes, the checks,
yeah,
all of that stuff. And even though that part of Marlin's statement shouldn't have been admitted,
right,
it didn't ultimately affect the outcome because they had such a strong case to begin with. So this is a case that really highlights how important those plea allocutions are, how carefully the courts will scrutinize them. And I think it also gives us a lot to think about in terms of, you know, the conscious avoidance doctrine and how it applies to these conspiracy cases.
Absolutely. And, you know, for you, the listener, I want you to kind of take a moment to consider something.
Right.
Given all of this, right, given how complicated these evidence rules can be, given how important the Confrontation Clause is,
yeah,
how do you think these procedural safeguards, how do they really impact the pursuit of justice, especially in these really complex financial crime cases?
Yeah.
You know, where's the balance between letting the jury hear all the evidence,
right,
and protecting the rights of the accused?
Big question.
Big questions. And this case really kind of throws those questions into sharp relief. So, you know, I encourage everyone to kind of dig into this a little bit more, think about it, and yeah, maybe we'll revisit this in a future episode.
Yeah, it's definitely a case worth revisiting and thinking about some of these bigger questions. Absolutely. Well, thanks for diving deep with us today.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure.
And we will see you on the next episode of The Deep Dive.